You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and I'm on tour, as you well know, in spring and, as I look at my diary, almost summer 2018. So if you'd like to find out more about that, go to comedianscomedian.com/tour. And you have 1 week left to get hold of your Comedians Comedian podcast t-shirt with the incredible Thanks Man slash horse design designed by the brilliant American illustrator Polly Becker. And so to do that, you can get to comedianscomedian.com/merch. That's /tour for the tour dates, /merch for the merchandise. It's a fairly simple system if you think about it. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and did I already say that? God, I'm tired. Listen, it's been pointed out to me that people sometimes start listening to this show having not heard other ones. Here's me assuming that the same 12 people that started listening 5 years ago are still on board, plus others who pick it up as they go along. So here's the skinny. If you're someone who's not familiar with the show, I take your favourite comedians one at a time and I push them up against a wall and shine a real flashlight into the ear of their psyche and demand to know what they're thinking about, why they're thinking it, where their creativity comes from, how they wield it, and generally what the hell is going on in their lives and how they cope with being a human being and an artist. That's the show. Today my guest is Sean Patton. Just such a pleasure to interview Sean at the Place Hotel, and my thanks as ever go to the Place Hotel at York Place in Edinburgh. If you're a high roller, you seriously want to be checking that out as a place to stay. They're very kind to me, and if you're a fan of the show and have got the necessary spondoolies, then get yourself along to the Place. Hugely excited to talk to Sean. I saw his show in Edinburgh. As you'll hear, it wasn't under perfect test conditions, but he dealt with what happened on that night masterfully. And he is someone who various members of mine, the ComCom Pod irregulars among the British comedy circuit, the people who like to give me a nudge and go, "Psst, you've got to see this person, this lady or gentleman is hilarious." He was someone, Sean, that many of the irregulars pointed him out to me on many occasions and said, you've got to get him. I hadn't seen anything from him. I deliberately didn't find out anything until I went along to his Edinburgh show at the festival just past. And so had that brilliant... Have you ever been to see a film and sat there and thought, I know nothing about this? I've only done it once. It was The Game by David Fincher. A brilliant, brilliant film to do that with. To go and see something where you know absolutely nothing about it. So I sat there thinking, right, here's a Sean Patton. We're going to find out what this is. And lo and behold, what a torrent was unleashed of beautiful, poetic, lyrical, kind of jazzy, jazz-inspired or infused or enthused, just really poetic comedy. Storytelling, but storytelling with such an exciting mixture of the profane and the, if not sacred, then at least... meaningful. The profane and the meaningful. Bit of a less lofty title than it might otherwise be. But you're going to be a huge fan of Sean. I know you are if you're into the stuff I'm into and you're listening to this, so probably some of you are. Do yourself a favour. Check out Sean Patton before or after this conversation with the gentleman himself.
I loved your show.
Thank you very much.
And I suppose the show that I saw... was the one where there was a stag do, a stag party dressed in superhero costumes. And they came in 1 minute before showtime, and I was sat on the front row quite diligently. I love sitting on the front row if I don't know the comedian.
Sure,
I
feel
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was sat there, and I nearly left. Do you know what I mean? Because it was like when it was a Friday or a Saturday night, they walked in with like 30 seconds to go.
You know who else nearly left? Me.
Yeah, right.
When I heard them coming in, it was one of these things where I was like, and I like peeked out and I saw one of them in a clown outfit. Mm-hmm. It was like a moment where I was like, I wonder if I could cancel the show right now. Because you got to be fucking kidding me. But go ahead. I'm glad we didn't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad we didn't as well, because I got to see someone completely master that situation. You totally bossed it.
Oh, well, thank you.
It was great, because your style of comedy, I mean, I didn't know what I was getting at all. You've been recommended to me by multiple people, and I'd done no research, and I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go and sort of, you know, experience the show. And when that happened, I thought, I wonder what's going to happen now. And from off stage already, it's not like you tore into them, but you just had absolute status.
Yeah.
And you just got them all. And they loved it. They stayed, they watched the show, they loved it. You barely got a peep out of them after that first couple of minutes.
Yeah.
So talk me through what kind of gears you were using at that point.
I mean, well, okay. This because I've done my research on your podcast as well. Okay. Which I was going to tell you, but then we were recording.
I didn't even see it
happen, which is one of the things the comedians tell me about your podcast. Like, you never know when he's recording. You never know when he's listening. No, but there's going to be a lot of therapeutic moments for me. One of the things I like the least about stand-up is having to do crowd work or banter. Because I think we call it crowd work, you guys call it banter. But like, I don't mind. I like it when it happens naturally in a good moment where I like it when it's not, you know, heckle based. When it's like, so, like for example, last night someone cheered at a very inappropriate moment in the show, but only because they didn't know what I was about to say. So, but they cheered in reaction to something, which only made what I said next that much better.
Gotcha.
And we had a quick moment of like, that kind of crowd works great. But the kind where it's expected, where people fucking show up and sit up front in a goddamn superhero outfits or with a silly hat on, or like, yeah, it's the drunk, you know, the bachelorette or the bachelor stag or 10 or when it's like expected, get the fuck out of my face with that bullshit. Take that, go to a fucking bar and just let drunks do it. I hate it. It's so fucking boring. It's the same shit over and over again. Look how dumb you look. Oh, gee, how gay are you? That mind-bending riff that we all end up finding ourselves, myself including, guilty of in the past of doing. You know, they're like, oh, where are you from? That's where all the idiots are from. Who's getting what? Who's engaged? More like, this person's engaged.
Sure.
Who's the Carrie in the group? Sex and the City reference. It's the same fucking boring bullshit that I have no... It boggles my mind why anyone would want to be a part of that. Right? So when I step out at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is, as far as I've been told my entire career thus far, the most prestigious, highbrow festival of the arts. And I see a fucking, as you call them, which I'm going to try and take this back to the state, the stag party.
Yeah.
It just sounds more like what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I see a fucking stag party in costumes, my instinct is to just take them down. And if it has to happen, the entire show with me. Like, I was willing to suffer the consequences of it then being an awkward, bad night. Unapologetically. I knew what I was doing. But it's one of those situations where it's like, and I don't think that they, I think I lucked out. I think we all lucked out in the audience as well. Because they were the good, they were that 1%, 2% good stag party.
They were actually there for a show.
But as one of them pointed out when I was asking, they did expect to just be rattled, to be riffed on and noodled and canoodled and poked fun at. That's why they show up to a comedy show dressed that way.
Yes, you know? And I think part of what I saw in the night, and I think part to do with what you've just described, is because you were prepared to take the show down with you, and that's a lovely way of describing it. Because there is, it feels so much, I think, like a personal attack. When you're excited about the show, and at the last fucking second, you go, "Oh, great, this is going to ruin it." Well, I'm going to ruin it. You know, that instinct that I find I have to struggle against sometimes. But I think I think what came across was your resolve in like, well, I'm happy for this to go wrong, gave you the ability to take risks, and consequently meant that you came across as really bomb-proof. You know,
well, what you just said, I think, is actually. It should be anyone who really wants to do comedy professionally. It should be your mantra, your core belief. It's like you should always be willing to take the show down with you. You should. I mean, I'm not saying do it every time you step foot on stage, but like, I do this because I fucking love this. I love this craft, you know. And there are some brilliant comedians who focus mainly on crowd work out there. There are some brilliant guys who, you know, the Todd Glasses of the world. But he's another beast. He's almost like, it's almost like sometimes you wonder if he even realizes if he's on stage or not.
Yeah.
Or if he always thinks it's brilliant. It's just like, let him go. Yeah. He's almost like a wild animal. It's like, let Todd go, man, and just observe the beauty of it. The big Jay Oakersons, you know, he's a fucking Jedi. It's like, you know, but it's almost like he writes jokes because he knows he's going to interact with the crowd.
Yes.
You know, Moshe Kasher's. I'm only naming Americans here because I don't know that many.
Sure.
You know, I'm not that familiar with a lot of British comedians. With Daniel Kitson, I've seen do some brilliant crowd work, but I've also seen do some brilliant, giant 20-minute bits. You know,
sure.
And that's that's just what it's about. It's about like, I want to see, when I'm watching comedy, I want to see the idea. I want to see what your idea is. I want to see what you're presenting me with that is going to like open me up, that's going to make me think, that's going to make me laugh because I'm taking this ride with you, right? So I want to do the same thing. And I work very fucking hard on those ideas. So when I get in front of a crowd and then right away there's some drunk asshole who just wants me to call him an idiot and point out that he's Welsh and that he bones sheep or whatever that fucking stereotype that I've now heard 30 comics bring up, that the Welsh have sex with sheep, apparently, which I guess is the equivalent of our entire South being,
absolutely. It's
right.
Exactly.
It's a thing, but it's a thing when you walk out there, you're like, why do I have to deal with this fucking bullshit?
Yeah.
So point being to your point is, but you should always be willing to take the show down with you because in my opinion, let's just hypothetically say that show had gone fucking horrifically awry. I had offended that group. Everybody felt awkward. There was a weird back and forth now. Some people left, but here's the difference. Is that I'm such a fucking maniac that even in those moments of dire, horrid, whoops, I fucked that all up. Even in those moments when the show is sinking with me, I will still commit to doing the show. So if I would have done that, I know you would have been in there and you would have appreciated it.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's at least one, you know, like if you get that one person who really loves it, maybe they, you know, maybe you're going to lose the other 49 people in the audience, but you get that one person, who knows? Then they tell five of their friends. And then the next thing you know, next time you're doing the show, 10 people are coming who've all heard.
Yeah, it has to be.
You know, you build this. You build the thing. You gain actual. I'd rather perform in front of 100 fans than 1,000 people.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, so it's like, or 100 believers and fans of comedy specifically, than just people who are like, oh, a comedy show.
Yeah.
Were anyone on TV? Let's go find out.
Yeah, but it's the tragedy of every comedian, I guess.
That,
you know, you can't start with the fans.
No.
You know, you have to work your way through all the.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. And also, but yeah, like what you saw that night, I mean, there's definitely less of an act of bravery, more of an act of just like sheer fucking psychotic, like insecurity, really. But it maybe isn't that how all bravery starts out?
Yeah, right.
You know, just
yeah, I'm thinking of a children's crazy story where they're like the parent says to the little rabbit or whatever, it's like, can I know when I get this, I feel this, I'm connecting this with the comedian Tom Tuck in my mind, maybe he told me this. And like, you know, can a rabbit still be brave when he's afraid? That is the only time a rabbit can be brave.
That's
exactly.
That's 100% right.
So well, let's talk about the ideas. Yeah. You said the idea and your commitment to the idea and wanting to hear what someone's idea is.
Right.
The show that I saw, I felt like it was two half-hour stories that were beautifully intertwined, and you know, there were really exciting narrative loops, and then but they contained a lot of stand-up, just punchy stuff. It wasn't like a storytelling show, in that sense. Talk to me about the kind of the relative weight of the ideas in the show.
Well, I mean, the idea of the reason why I'm at this festival, and I'm going to say this, I'll say this, 3 weeks in, I love it. I really do. Like, I see why, I completely understand why a lot of people, a lot of American comedians have come back just like, nope.
Okay.
Nope. A lot have come back loving it, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, if you booked a show that was, contained the American comedians who've tried to talk me out of doing this, you could charge £75 a ticket because it'd be a good show.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but I get it because, you know, it's a different beast. It's like, you know, we don't have reviewers, really.
Sure.
And that sort of thing in the States. We have, you know, comedy critics and people who write up there. But American stand-up, I'm sure you've had this conversation, you know, it's just, it's a different expectation. It's not supposed to be connected or even that similar every time you perform it. When you're headlining, it's just, you know.
It's just whatever you do. You turn up and you do your
Or you just, you don't, your ideas, it can be a bunch of non sequiturs strung together or a bunch of, you know, I think every comedian likes to have a flow in their material, but the only thing really connecting it all together is the comedian themselves. And when I do clubs in the States, generally that's what I do as well. You know, bits, and I change it up every night because the audience, the American audiences aren't expecting a theme, really. They're just sort of expecting to laugh, right? Which is great, because then you get better at making your shit funnier, you know? Making your ideas hit more and more solid, more streamlined, and more like, bam, humor. Mm-hmm. But the idea of doing a show with a narrative and a theme and an arc, like, that's hard to do regularly in the U.S. as a comedian. So that's what enticed me about coming here, was like, I've always loved that idea, and the few times I've seen it executed well coming up, it was like, man, like that's something I really want to do, you know? So I spent the past year or so working on the show you saw. And, you know, the theme really is just my bedwetting and my OCD, how they tied together to kind of shape me. And then through that, you see, you know, I use the stories you've seen that were big monumental moments in my life that like kind of changed me and made me who I am. So it was about identifying those things. Like, what do I actually want to talk about in my life that isn't just bullshit? That isn't just the time, you know, I got, yes, we've all had our heart broken, but what about more than that, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, what about some actual experiences? And then, you know, what ties these together and why do I want to talk about this and what does it really showcase about? Because when I first wrote the show, it had nothing to do with my OCD because it's a hard thing to talk about because it sounds so fucking insane. It really does. And it sounds, some people think I'm kidding or some people think I'm like making that kind of shit up. But like I had there was a dude 2 nights ago who afterwards were at that bar across from my the little bunker bar, and he came over with his mate, and they were saying nice things about the show. And the guy was like, "Oh, I just want to say in parting, I'm a psychotherapist. Fucking bang up job describing OCD."
Yeah,
he's like, because I get a ton of people who just come to me and assume that they're obsessive compulsive when they really have no idea what it means.
Yeah.
So, and you clearly do. I was like, "Yeah, thank you, psychotherapist." As time progressed, it just became more and more obvious. I was like, I have to start talking about this. I really have to get it out there. And then, bam. So that sort of came to be. But, like, the best, you know, How can I say this without... Well, I'm about to do the thing that you told me. No, please do. This sounds so pretentious. But the moment the comedian becomes... the moment of a rhythm or a... gets too dominant in your set is the moment boredom will start to set in for the audience.
The moment rhythm becomes too dominant.
The moment they can predict your... I think the moment the audience gets like, okay, this guy's set up, punch. Set up, punch.
Yes, okay.
Okay, this guy's longer-winded. But the moment you... And I don't think it's a conscious thing. I think it's a thing just from... Because there are comedians out there that I've seen who in 20 minutes will blow my mind. Are just fucking spectacular. But who in 40 minutes, I'm fucking dying. I'm like, please wrap this up. I get it. You know, and vice versa. There are comedians I've seen who in 20 minutes, it's like, what the fuck is going on? But in an hour, I'm like, well, please don't get off stage. Please keep going. Please keep going. So it's like, you know, so for me, it's like, I try my hardest to never let the audience identify my rhythm. Subconsciously, anyway. Never let them see, like I don't want to ever be predictable on stage, right? So with a show like what I'm doing here, I feel like I am fighting the nat, because it's a natural thing in any performance. It's a natural thing that starts to happen. You start to fall into a rhythm and people start to pick up on the rhythm. And the next thing you know, you're all on the same. It's that sort of thing when you're watching a show and everyone's just like, ha 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 ha. Like, it's almost like you feel it's like the whole show is on autopilot. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying we've all experienced that both on stage and off. Where you're just like, everyone's in this. It's almost like you can, and then da-da-da-da-da-da, bah! Good night! Like, you can just kind of feel it coming. Nothing wrong with that, but that's kind of the natural progress of it. I say fight against it. So I want the audience to, at one moment, think, oh, here comes another one of those. Oh, Jesus Christ, what happened? And now what? We're upside down? And then the next moment, oh, God, okay, if this is how it is, fuck it. I'm here now. I'm in this crazy thing. Whoa, now I'm laughing again. Yeah. In a way that I didn't think I would again. Where before I was laughing, you better just laugh to keep this monster at bay. And then you laugh because, it's not a monster. He just had a mask on. You know, so... I know that sounds insane. I don't do any mask work.
No, I mean, but I'm just wondering whether this is there like an exponent of this sort of thing within comedy that you've gone, I've noticed this person doing this.
Yeah.
Or is it something you've discovered for yourself based on what you didn't want to do? I mean, the obvious analogy to draw is like, you're the only person I've had from New Orleans on the show, and you've just described jazz and masks, and you know,
there you go. That's pretty good. I wasn't thinking about that at all. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, like I feel like there are elements in my show that are very dark and that are very like non-traditional and dare I say even emotional. But for me, if the right amount of that highlights the comedy. You know what I mean? Makes it all that much. And I think that's any great comedic piece you've ever seen, from stand-up act, from a fucking 10-minute set to a two-hour movie even. Like, just the peppering in the right amount of drama, the right amount of, like, actual raw emotion only springboards the comedy to the next level. Yes, there are great absurdists out there and observational humorists, so you maybe don't see the emotion on the surface there, but it's there in some way, you know? Maybe it's behind it. Just go, jokes, all about you. Some people like myself want to kind of put it out there a little bit more. Just like, here it is. This is some harsh shit to just sort of stomach right now, but trust me, in a minute, ha-ha, see? But I don't want the audience to know that. I don't want them to ever feel. I like keeping them on their toes. And that's sort of the biggest critique I've gotten of this show, which people say it to me like it's insulting. And I'm like, oh, God, thank you.
Go on.
Is like, I was confused as to how to feel. I'm like, yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Because that meant you weren't bored. And you're going to be thinking about this for a minute.
Yes, and you weren't just going, yep, this is the rhythm, and now this happens, and now there'll be a lull,
you'll be
an emotional climax, and then we'll wrap up. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of thing. But that's this, like I said, this is a show that's hard to pull off in the States. So once I kind of got it, you know, the bones of it and the meat, once I got it to where it was ready to walk, you know, I was, when you do clubs in the U.S., I don't want to feel like I'm ever like mansplaining.
Yanksplaining.
America. Yanksplaining.
So this is Sean. Tremendous fun talking to Sean. We'll get right back to him in a second, in the second half of this interview. Just a quick reminder, the tour dates, of course, comedianscomedian.com/tour. If you'd like to come and see me do my own stand-up comedy, and for those of you just joining us, yes, as well as being an interviewer of stand-up comedians and someone who, in interviews, likes to try and make himself as invisible as possible and let the subject breathe, let them talk and spend a bit of time, I am also a stand-up comedian of, I have to say, some repute. Is that the phrase? I think, yeah, I've got a decent amount of repute. And I'm going to be embarking on my third national tour. So if you're in Britain and you want to come and get a piece of my pie, I will never say that again, then come along to comedianscomedian.com/tour and you can see the 40-odd dates I'm doing. There will also be some shows in London at somewhere or other. We're waiting for some people to get back to us. And if you're a British comic, you can imagine who that is. So thank you for those of you who've already been in touch and gone, hey, why aren't you nearer me? Listen, start a base camp wherever you live and fill it with ComCom Pod fans or Stu Goldsmith fans and get them to email me and demand, oh God, have I just asked more of you to badger me? Yeah, why not? Why not? I'm trying to come to places where I think I've got an audience and we're building it slowly but surely year on year. I can't wait for you to see this show, one of the top 20 best reviewed shows at the Edinburgh Fringe this year out of something like a million shows? Something like a million shows. So come along and see those. Last chance for comedianscomedian.com/merch to get hold of the t-shirts if you'd like to. And remember, all of the cool people that you know who listen to this podcast all like to regularly subscribe and donate to the show at comedianscomedian.com/donate. And they either do that with a one-off donation of sometimes £5, £10, £20 or whatever you'd spend, whatever they'd spend indeed, on a high-priced bottle of wine to celebrate a special occasion. You can determine that amount yourself and chuck that on my bonfire. I think I've got a bit mad. I've been driving for a long time and I'm sat in my car in somewhere that claims to be Yelverton and yet is absolutely not Yelverton. Such are the vagaries of a life on the comedy circuit. So, someone is coming towards my car now and they're looking suspicious. I wonder if they are going to make contact with me. Apparently not. They're walking past. And now I feel bad. What they are going to do is tip a load of bottles into the recycling. What a fabulous time this is. So, can you hear that? That's some recycling happening live on the Comedians Comedian podcast. Now, as I mean, I can see she's clearly got about 30 bottles left. It seems like a great opportunity to... What, have I got anything on bottles? This is so lovely. I can't not do this. Talk about jazz. Talk about rolling with the circumstances. Maybe I'll take this opportunity to talk about something breaky. Yeah, those are the wine bottles, right? If you want to donate, then this lady has clearly been buying a lot of wine. Something, something, something. You should donate to the show. How's that? That's all I can come up with at short notice. I think she's nearly done. And that's the last of them. And we're done. So, what a lot of fun we've had. Let's get back to the interview with Sean Patton. I will deal in the postamble after this show with a little bit of personal business and indeed some of your reactions to last week's very invigorating interview with Mr. Reginald D. Hunter. So do listen to that if you haven't already. Let's get back to the fabulous Sean Patton.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Like, I came over to England earlier this year to do, because I have agents over here, and I was like, I want to do clubs. I want to just see the clubs. So I did all the Glees.
Okay.
You know, and you see that it's a different thing here. The fact that you only need 20 minutes to headline mm-hmm. is amazing, mm-hmm. but mind-boggling. Because in the States, you need to be able to do at least 45, yep. and there is not going to be a break. You're going to have to, like, by the time the show gets to you, the audience is on that. They're at that tip. Oh, yeah, either they need a break, or you need to bring them so much to another level of enjoyment that they forget that they need a break.
Yep.
You know, so I think bookers in both countries need to have like a fucking meeting and like decide a new format, because I agree with elements of both. You know, I think the American shows are shorter and there's more of like a build.
Yep.
But I feel like the pacing of the British shows, with the breaks and the absence of wait staff, keeps them engaged a little longer.
Yep.
Because they get to get up and smoke a cigarette and take a dump and,
yep.
you know, get some, oh, that's fucking garbage, or, oh, that was great, whatever, and go back, reset. But anyway, point is, when you do the clubs in the States, you do similar. You do 5 to 7 shows over 3 to 4 days. So I would have to, like, pick the right show, because sometimes when you do a club, you walk out and the entire audience is that stag party we were yep. talking about earlier. You're like, there's no fucking way I'm going to trust them. So I'm just going to batter them down, just hit them, fucking bludgeon them into laughter, and then good night, get off stage as soon as, you know.
And is that a case of changing the material that you were planning to do, or is yeah. it a case of changing the performance of that material?
Both. So, like, this show that you saw that we were talking about here at the fest, there's so many bits of mine that are stand-up bits that I could just erase when performing this. I could just take out all of the, like, emotional, thematic part.
Yep.
And just focus on the bits. Give, yep. you know, and just to punch those up, just to solidify those a little more, just to make those more powerful. And then if I got out there and you could see it was an audience of, like, because there's this belief. Here's two things I wish everyone would stop thinking when it comes to comedy. A, that younger audiences are better audiences. That is horseshit. I don't know why the fuck. Like, get a 19-year-old audience? No fucking thank you. A bunch of people who have no real life experience and only laugh at fucking loud beeps and buzzing sounds, basically. I mean, no offense, but, like, I've performed in front of, like, you know, colleges in the States. It's some of the worst fucking audiences I've ever been in front of, and it has nothing to do with the whole PC culture nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's all about the fact that they cannot really understand what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They've been through very little life at that point. Also, that drunk audiences are better. Fuck you. I hate a drunk audience. Drunk makes you more confident. Sure, it'll make you ha 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 laugh a little freer, but also makes you stupider. It makes you slower and less able to process what's actually being said on stage. That's why you notice drunk audiences only laugh at, you know, sexual / relationship based / who's the president that we all hate jokes. You know, fuck that. Give me a fucking stone cold sober 28-year-old crowd. Now we're talking. You know, they've got some life and they're actually listening. But anyway, so sometimes it's hard, but you get out there and you see that good audience, you can be like, oh, I'm going to trust you guys with this and go for it. It doesn't always pay off, but sometimes it would. But that means I was really only able to do it 1 or 2 nights in its entirety at every club. So it was like harder to consistently develop,
yes.
which makes me appreciate what the UK comedians do by developing an hour every year, where it's like, Jesus Christ, that is like,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, nose to the grindstone, fucking face to the fire. Like, there's no, it's kind of just like, well, here's the show. I've been breaking my ass making this happen. Let's hope you like it. You know, like, fuck, that is crazy. But it also makes me appreciate it. Like, what goes on at this festival, that you see people going up with something they've been working on for the past year, and it's being judged. It's being torn apart in some cases by these fucking reviewers. And who are they? And it's funny because you hear, you know, you go to all the performer bars, you hear this in the same sentence. You will hear, oh, nobody fucking watched. Nobody cares about the reviews. Don't worry about the reviewers. Oh, you got 4.5 from the Scotsman. Oh, man. Congratulations.
Yeah.
It's like you just told that person reviews don't mean shit. And then the person next to him that their fest is set because they got the 4.5 star review or the 5-star review. It's like these things that people simultaneously ignore and yet live their life by. And it's like, fuck. And it's only been a year working on this material. And you expect a fucking So I can understand how this festival drives people mad. But at the same time, I love how it what it brings out of people. But anyway, point being, I hope I've answered your question, because I feel like I've just fucking pontificated off into another realm.
No, absolutely. We're all, you know, still, this is all absolutely, yeah, within the realm of, mm, of the podcast.
Yeah.
I think I'm interested to know.
Yeah.
What? I've got a couple of things. Got a couple of things lined up. I've got to choose
what order
I want to do them in. Let's talk about some of the.
I've got an order. I've got a lineup.
Yeah. I got a lineup. What am
Let's
I running?
See, who's going to open? Who's opening? Who's opening this show?
So something I think is quite interesting about your show is it did have a certain. I don't know quite what the word is. It's not scatological. It's not dirty. But it's definitely pretty graphic.
It's definitely like filthy.
Like, I tried to describe it. I said, it's so great. It's 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
One's about balls and the other one is about farting. With, you know what I mean? I didn't want to open this interview with that because I wouldn't want people to switch off, because I then immediately said to my friend, but that doesn't even describe it at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. That interesting point, because I've also, because of the reviews I've gotten, okay, there's two reviews that I've gotten that have been 3-star reviews that were very fucking nice reviews. Like, I can't, like, both reviewers said wonderful things about me.
A 3 that reads like a 4. Welcome to Edinburgh.
Exactly. But said one. That's fucking, oh God, I hear myself saying this. I'm like, oh God, I wonder how many times this sort of sentence has been at
it
was a 2-star, but trust me,
yeah.
Read it. But they both said,
the official position on this podcast is that reviews don't exist. There's no such thing as a critic. There's no such thing as a comment.
So
we can talk about it.
There it goes. All right. So, but they both said like wonderful things about me as a performer and all this nice shit, but they both dropped the star level down because of the material was quite icky.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say, this sounds like the most pretentious thing you're going to fucking hear. That is not entirely not by design, because I do not like pretentious any art form. Go away. You know what I mean? Like, subject matter, in my opinion, cannot, you really, execution is key to me. Originality is in execution, right? So, farting, having genitals, wetting the bed, all these things that I talk about in the show that are very, you know, basic 101, you know, lowbrow, as some people would say. Yes, but they are all things that every single human being experiences. Every single human being experiences these things across the board, across the racial divide, gender divide, class divide. We all know exactly what these things are. And I think I discuss all of these things in the most highbrow possible way, right? And I've researched certain things. I mean, this is giving away a joke in the show, but I don't care. I researched the concentration of pheromones in a human fart. That's a factual thing I talk about on stage. That, like, you could walk through someone's fart and without realizing it, all of your, every single bell in your subconscious has gone off, and you are now sexually and emotionally and all across the board aroused, and you don't even realize it.
Yeah.
You know? And if you ever saw the person who farted again, just their natural pheromones that come off their body would you'd immediately be attracted to them based on the fart you smelled earlier that you didn't even realize happened. You know what I'm saying? Like,
okay.
It's like, but like that, when you just, how many fucking people get fucking doctorates to discuss this sort of shit. I'm not saying I'm on that level by any means. I'm simply saying I'm not just talking about farting and then going, farting, right?
Yeah.
P.U., those things. I find the thread that's like, no, this is why I'm discussing
and I also, for the sake of people who are listening to this, who haven't seen the show, it's not simply a case of, like, your fart jokes are better researched, but they're also, they are within, you know, this whole thing of you talking about your OCD, talking about your bedwetting, it's almost like the basis of the material itself is icky and confessional and consequently emotive and meaningful.
Yeah. No, well, thank you. Why don't you write it? I know you said reviews don't exist.
No, I'm not. No,
but could that be?
I'm never going there. I'm never going over the wall.
thank you. Stay on this side. That's another thing. I know you said reviews don't resist, but then I got like one really great review, and it was from a reviewer who they were like, "Wow, God, this guy's terrifying. Oh God, if he comes to your show." He hates everything.
Sure.
He's going to tear everything apart. And he gave me like a sterling review. So it was a moment of like, oh, okay. The fucking, the warrior sees that I can do battle. You know?
Yes.
But subject matter is important. That is a fact, of course. But it's also about how you execute it, right? So, I mean, Jesus Christ, we can across the board. That can lead to so many arguments in comedy. I mean, with certain, rape jokes, racism jokes, you know, things, anything, wherever. I mean, yes, subject matter can initially be very like, ooh. And even for me, I've had times where someone brings something up on stage and it's like, whoa. But then if it's properly executed and if it goes somewhere, awesome. Awesome. If someone gets on stage and their opening joke is, fuck the comedian Sean Patton, that fucking piece of shit. Of course I'm going to be like, what? But if they really, if they execute that well, if they highlight some things, I'll be like, ah, oh, God damn it, they got a point. That is funny. God damn it, I am annoying. You know what I mean? Like, so that's what I look at when I was writing the show and coming to Scotland with it. I was like, man, there are going to be some people. I know there are going to be some haters on that level because there are some people who can't watch comedy beyond a premise. That's a fact. You know it as well as I do.
And were you kind of intimating earlier on that part of the pleasure for you or part of the point of including that stuff is almost as a deliberate flag for you to recognize if someone is offended by that, then you don't care about them.
Pretty much. Yeah. But also, I mean, look, I say this lots on my website, but like at a certain point, what are you doing comedy for? You know, I like to expose the beauty of human flaw, right? It's the one thing that unites us all. We're all flawed, disgusting individuals, humans. Pretending like we aren't, and I get that, that's part of society, but we are all bound by one commonality, human flaw, and I love it. I love reveling in it. It'll save us. Accepting it will save us one day. So for me, right now, for this show, the flaw part that I really wanted to talk about and bring up was the disgusting side of it all. But also, like you're saying, how it connects to a mental disorder I have.
Yes.
And how it, you know, shaped a lot of who I am. But basically, these are those moments where you're like, say this carefully, but not really. But at the same time, it's like, I don't want to please everyone. I don't want to. I don't fucking care to. In fact, I choose not to. It's not possible. You cannot please everyone. And if you attempt to please everyone, you become mediocre. There is no need for any more of that. The only way to truly be good at what you do is to do what you do and Focus on what it is. And know that it will turn people off. Know that some people aren't going to be into it. Know that some people are going to give you a shit review or walk out. Know that but know that for every person that doesn't like what you do is the person who loves what you do. And then you please them. And then they give you great reviews. And then they love your shit. And then they love coming to see you live. And then that's what you do it for. You've not compromised. You've stayed intact. You're an artist. You've created. Your integrity is there. And you are a happier, better, more amazing individual who makes better art, better comedy, and it gets to more people who need to hear it slash see it, whatever, because you're pure. Whereas if you go the other way, what are you then? Just someone who has to please everyone? Just someone who has to, across the board, make people? That's it. Fuck that. Fuck those people. They're not going to get you. Stop trying to make them. Make your own meat. This is what I'm doing. Ah, look at how great this is. And let them come to you. That's how I look at it. So that's what I mean by design. I mean, this is my back at home too. Like, I go on stage and you know sometimes people aren't going to get this. Some people aren't going to get this, or some people just aren't going to be into this. But some people are. Fuck yeah. Good for those people. There's 8 billion people on the planet. Don't try and fucking make them all laugh. You can't.
I'm just staying silent for a second there, so I've got to clean out editing-wise, because that's definitely making the next compilation. I think that's you're completely right. I think that's invigorating. I think that's inspiring. Yeah. My question is,
please,
how do you know that? How have you arrived at that apprehension of the situation?
Because I've been doing this a long time. And I used to be that. This isn't a struggle individual to me, but like, I think every comedian when starting out, especially like, you know, when I moved to New York, or when I moved to LA first and then I moved to New York, you find yourself, there's this phase in your career. Me personally, I found myself on stage just trying to crush, trying to kill. That was my sole purpose to get on stage. It was like, you got to get up there and you got to kill it every time. But then the more you do this, you realize that the more, to me, and this is just for me, killing is not the main goal. Being funny is the goal. And those are two different things. And if you don't understand what I mean by that and you're a performer, keep performing. Right? It's two different things. Killing isn't difficult. Killing anyone with any amount of skill set could kill. I mean, a monkey taking a shit on a snare drum will kill. You know what I'm saying? But being funny, now that's hard. Being funny is hard because being funny requires so much. It requires so much, sometimes subtlety, sometimes grandiose, sometimes, you know, sometimes rapid, sometimes slow and deliberate. You know, there's no formula for funny. There's a formula for killing. There's no formula for funny. Funny is hard. And sometimes it doesn't get a laugh right away. Sometimes it doesn't get a huge laugh right away. In fact, the biggest laugh I see when something's truly funny is people fighting the laugh. Is that like even though they're at a comedy show where people have been openly laughing for however long the show's been going on, the laugh you see when someone's clearly trying not to audibly laugh, like they're trying in a way to almost like they're fighting it, that's when you know that they've found something you said truly funny, because they don't know how to feel about it yet. They are a little worried that maybe even, oh God, should I be laughing at that? Or, oh my God, am I laughing at that? Or, oh my God, I'm laughing so hard at this, it might fucking embarrass me. Like, but that's I love that. I love when I see that. The problem is, oftentimes you can't hear that. You can just sort of see it and you're like, okay, shit. But point is, killing me. Oh yeah, so I look at it like a night of drinking, okay? Killing is getting shit-faced, right?
Yeah.
And if you go out with a night of drinking with the sole purpose of getting shit-faced, that's easy. Just keep them coming. Bam, bam. Do shots of whiskey until you're vomiting, passed out, arrested. But you know, in the street, wake up, no wallet. What happened? You got shit-faced. That was your goal. Anyone could do that. But going out for a night of drinking and having fun, that's being funny. That's the balance, okay? That's knowing how much to drink, when to drink. Do I take this shot? Maybe not. Maybe actually, yeah, let's take a shot. Let's talk to this person. Sure, let's go to this other bar. All right. And you have this amazing night because you do it right. And then being shit-faced, that's the side effect of being funny. Or I'm sorry, being shit-faced is a side effect of having a good time. Thus as killing is a side effect of being funny. That's how I feel. So you get a lot of industry that'll just tell you, you just got to get up there and kill it. You just got to get up there and kill it and get up there and kill it. But when you, I find that when you write for the sole purpose of just killing, you end up robbing yourself and the audience of any true comedy. You get to this point where all you're fucking doing is writing these basic bitch material. And I don't mean to offend anyone, but you know what I mean. You're writing this basic, just, you're hitting the well-tread territory. You're, the topics, the dating, the shit that requires no thought to actually comprehend. It's just the paths that many comedians before you have taken. And whatever. Some people love that, but like, everyone who is a fucking legend in comedy, in my opinion, went the other way. Went the, I'm going to be funny, which means I'm going to take risks, which means it's not always going to quote unquote kill, but it is going to be funny. And that in its own way kills, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's it.
Did that make sense?
Completely. Yeah. I think that's a very good analogy. And I want to talk to you in a moment about your, about more specifically about the writing and your knack for analogy and your knack for language, which I think you have a fantastic use of
language. Well, thank you.
Before we get to that, I just want to stay with this, with the stuff that you just said. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Why you? Why is that important to you? What does it serve in you to, like you mentioned, the guys who are legendary.
Okay.
Do you want to be legendary? What would it mean to you to be legendary? What was it? What would it fix within you that is currently, what would it satisfy within you?
Man, that's a, what would it fix within me? Jesus. That's a good one. You guys can't see Stuart's face right now, but man, is he happy with that. Man, is he happy with that one.
I hate it when my guests point out what I'm doing, Simon.
God damn,
he's looking happy with myself. My clever question.
Oh man, I mean, I don't know, because you know, if we're all broken in some way, isn't being broken what we eventually, isn't being broken in itself what is being fixed? See what I'm saying? So by that question, by that rationale, were all of us already broken, and what we perceive now as being broken was what actually us being fixed, because it turns us into who we are, kind of thing, right? People always ask, what's your big, you know, you always talk about your biggest comedic influences, right? And comedy for me growing up was not like, sometimes I talk to these comedians who were, you know, I was watching, you know, the Bob Hope show at 9 years old and knew I wanted to be a comedian. And that's great. You know, awesome. Growing up for me, I wasn't really exposed to that sort of shit. I mean, or that sort of thing. I didn't really, my parents weren't really TV watchers. You know, they were more, so I was just more of like a kid wandering around by himself, daydreaming, making myself laugh. But growing up, my dad was a very funny man. My mom was very funny. My parents are hilarious, hilarious people. And I grew up in southeastern Louisiana. You know, it's a funny city. Everybody's fucking drunk and has got a real sloppy, because a true New Orleans accent, truthfully, sounds more like, if you like a New York accent, like a Brooklyn, you know, like a fucking New York guy. You know, hey, what are you looking at? What the fuck, where am I from? I'm from right here. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Who's asking? You, who the fuck are you? Yeah, take that guy, or girl, to be honest. I mean, if they're Brooklyn enough, you can't tell the difference between the genders. They all sound the same. But take that Brooklyn person and give them like 5 Valium, right? And once it sets in, now you got a New Orleans accent. It's just sort of a slow guy from Brooklyn with a drawl who's just drunk and fucking talking about it. Where you got your hair cut, huh? At a free haircutting spot? Shut up. Fuck you. Well, who? Hey, nice shirt. What was it, a pair of pants yesterday? And you're like, what? those are terrible examples. But you know what I mean? It's just...
it's a funny vibe. The people in the street
just,
are funny.
And it's a place, you know, growing up, you see tourists coming and drunk and crying and wasted and, you know, showing up to family restaurants expecting, you know, tits. It's just crazy. But my biggest comedic influence is the show Mr. Show, right? Bob Odenkirk, David Cross... I mean, shit, also Paul F. Tompkins, Jack Black, and Sarah Silverman are also on that show. But I saw it in high school when I was, you know, it started airing when I was like a sophomore in high school. And it changed me, like warped my mind. And everyone has this when they discovered the thing. But it like, I mean, it's beautiful to me. That show is a work of art from start to finish. Even the bad episodes are fucking beautiful. All right. And there are sketches they did, you know, this is mid-90s that they could never get away with today. They pushed the boundaries. They pushed the envelope. And the main thing they did, you notice, was that it wasn't like they never, for example, they never did impersonations of current famous, you know, politicians, for example. They just, and this Bob Odenkirk, I read, he was one, he wrote this book and I read, he pointed this out in their book and I was like, God damn, you're right. But they did impersonations of the archetype, yeah. Right? Which repeats itself for every Newt Gingrich, you've now got a fucking, you know, Steve Bannon. Well, they're not that similar at all, but they're both pieces of shit. Fuck you guys. But they made a product within, I don't know if they did this consciously or not, but something that will live on forever. Something that you can watch now, 20 years later, and still be like, fuck, that is funny. Because it isn't centered around, you know, a George Michael impersonation or a Madonna impersonation.
Yes, yes,
or a fucking...
It's archetypal.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, that's the idea, is like... Because you watch some stand-up from, like, 20 or so years ago, and no matter how good it is, it's like, eh. You know what I mean? It just doesn't reside. It doesn't resonate anymore because Bill Clinton hasn't been in office for 20 years. Or, you know what I mean? It's like, I just don't, eh. But the idea of something that can live on, that's what it's about for me. That's what legendary is. And the idea of, like, how many times I quoted those Mr. Show sketches to my friends growing up. How many of my friends, by the time they saw the sketch or an episode of Mr. Show, knew it already because I'd fucking talked about it so much. Yeah. And how many times I would be, you know, in a weird mood or just not, you know, fucking wanting to deal with anyone, and I would put in Mr. Show DVD. Or as time progressed, log on to HBO. And then fucking watching it, you just watch an episode just for like, it's zen to me. That's how fucking great that show was.
I'm going to ask the same question again, now, but nearer the answer. But what does that mean
to me?
To you? What would it like to become? I understand what you mean by legendary, the sort of stuff that people say to their friends. Is it to do with friendship? Like the kid that you were watching that, it sounds like it saved you or it felt like it healed you. And is it that you want to pass that on to other people?
If I could
heal that kid,
dude. If I could make one person feel the way I did about what I do, how I felt about Mr. Show, I'd be clocked out right now. You know, fuck it, done. Walk off. Give me a high enough cliff and a bottle of good scotch, and I'll fucking do the best Fringe show anyone's ever seen. When I jump off laughing the whole way down because
no one
I've
has done that yet. That's the one idea.
Because I have fucking achieved it. For me it's about creating something that people really feel. You know, that someone really just like, oh, like you relate to it, you feel it, and it guides you in a way that's like, you know, hey man, I'm okay. I'm not this fucking reclusive shithead monster. People think like me. I'm just different. I'm just flawed. Like them. And there's something about you, about yourself you begin to...
Did you feel like a monster?
I felt like a I felt like a complete outcast for a lot of my life. Yes. Still to this day, I do sometimes, because still to this day, I go hang out at, you know, comedy clubs, and when there becomes like a, when a comics table situation arises, I get a little weird about it, because there's, because that high school bullshit hierarchy comes out even in those situations, you know, and then you all of a sudden you're the odd kid out. One of my favorite comedians ever is Maria Bamford. Okay, I adore Maria Bamford. And she, you talk about taking risks. There are few comedians out there who do a fucking special for just their parents, right? And I've heard so many other comedians shit on that. And it's like, why? Because she fucking did something truly funny? Because she took a risk? Because she immortalized something in a way that just another person standing there with their one hand in their pocket and their other hand kind of lazily holding a microphone telling one-liners will never immortalize? And that's what I fucking hate sometimes about the comics table situation, where it's like people start shitting on something because it's different. It's like, we were all different. That's why we ended up in this situation. How are you shitting on something for being different? The goal is to be different. And then you realize for a lot of comedians, no, it is. No, it isn't. For a lot of comedians, it's to kill and make money. And that can be a little devastating when you realize those can be some of your peers think that way. They don't care about leaving a mark or even truly being funny. So I still feel like an outcast sometimes. But growing up, absolutely. I just felt like, yeah, nothing I say or think people like. And every friend I have is only my friend because I'm sort of a quiet, friendly kid who will just let them bounce their ideas off me, because I'm just shy and don't have other friends, you know? So like, yeah, I felt like there was a thing about me that just felt like, well, I belong in the back of the classroom by myself, or alone on a, you know, weekend or week, you know, not being at the park. I just felt like I was a loner. And then Mr. Show, for example, was just something that made me realize that, hey, what other people perceive as weird in me is actually cool. There's something else. There's another world out there that is like, oh, people think like this and even weirder and even more out there. I'm just I'm a novice in that world. You know, I'm just the tip of an iceberg.
Do you now think that the kid you was right
about
being a loner and a weirdo?
Yeah.
Do you think that was a fair appraisal of the situation, or was that an appraisal driven by the fear and insecurity of being a kid?
Combination of the two. But yes, definitely, of course, fear and insecurity of being a kid always has something to do with it, you know? But definitely also, I mean, I still am. I still am a loner. I still, like, prefer to, like I prefer, I spend a good amount of my day alone by design, again, you know, because I need it. I need that alone time. I take a 1 hour walk every single day. It's one of the first things I do every morning. I didn't do it yet today, but my plan is to do it after this. But that alone time, that walk, and during that alone walk, if I see someone I know and they haven't seen me yet, I will avoid it. I will take a right or a left. Or if I bump into them, it's like, hey, I will act like I'm in a rush.
Yeah.
I'll be like, oh, I gotta run. Sorry. Because I need that alone time. I need, it's just an hour a day. Because I got it so much as a kid, you learn, you know, part of my personality is rooted in it. In that time spent alone, I need to just sort of recalibrate myself, right? So yes, to answer your question, yeah, I am, by nature, I am a loner and a bit of an awkward person. But not as dire as I thought then, you know? And not as tragic as I thought then, you know what I mean? It was just, I meet people sometimes who grow up in, like, you know, grow up in situations where they have like that one friend or that one kid who kind of like pulls them out of their, and I didn't have that as a kid. I had friends, but none of them really, I guess, got me on that level. You know,
the rescue friend.
Yeah, you know, I exactly. Right. You know, a rescue friend. Yeah, you know what? You know, I feel like I'm about to turn this around on you. Like, Stuart, do you need a rescue friend?
Well, no, you've just made me think of a very close friend of mine who I haven't really thought about in those terms, but certainly in my schooling, he was 100% my rescue friend.
He
was the person who went, this is fucked, right? And I was like, oh, God, yeah, I thought it was me.
Exactly.
And you didn't have that guy.
I did not have that person. I had the, this is awesome, right? Well, I don't know. Fuck you. I had those. I had 30 of those people, you know?
If you, assuming you continue to become more and more successful in comedy and are afforded opportunities and start to become one of the big, glitzy, successful comics.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in whether that is compatible with wanting to stay away from the comics table. If someone like Maria Bamford, a hero of yours, absolutely, I mean, I think she's incredible. I'll never forget her on stage at Just for Laughs in Montreal 2 years ago, looking at the audience and saying, I didn't even want to be here tonight. I mean, just incredible, unforgettable. But, you know, she is someone who is successful, but still on the outside.
Yeah.
And if you were to become as successful as you could, what's the relationship between that success and the comics table, the kind of the industry, the glitz, the rest of it?
Well, okay, there's the comics table, and then there's the comics corner. I feel like they're two different things, or the comics bar stool. There's always the comics table where. Every club has one where everybody, you know, there's the alphas sitting at the table and then the betas standing around hoping to be an alpha one day. And then the rest. And then, but then there's the group within the group down at the end of the bar standing, you know, four of them standing around a fucking bar stool having their own conversation. That's where I exist. That's where, because no one's paying attention to our conversation, and our conversation, I guarantee, is pretty good. Is it better than what's going on at the comedy table? I don't know. I'm not listening to what the fuck they're talking about over there.
It's the back of the classroom again.
Exactly.
Only now there's some friends.
Exactly. So it's like, I wouldn't say I actively avoid the comedy table, because the comics table, because it depends on the comics. Sometimes you walk in there, and other comedians like myself have sat down at the table. So now it's like, oh, I'll sit with this crew. I like these people. You know, we're talking actual ideas. We're fucking rapping about just fucking what's going on. But then sometimes you get at the comics table and you realize it's like, oh, this is another show. This is just another show happening. This is just another, you know, fucking.
It's everyone. An opportunity for the people who are at the top.
Right. And it's, but then you realize the people at the top avoid that table as well. Believe you me, I've seen it, you know, at the Comedy Cellar where you walk in and like Louis C.K. sitting at the table and then you see 45 minutes later that words got out that Louis C.K. sitting at the table. So he gets the fuck away from the table. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bill Burr, I think, just could give a shit about the table. You know, like you said, Maria Bamford. There's a level too where it's like you realize the table is great until someone notices it's the table. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's a club in New York. I love it. It's called The Stand. No affiliation to the clubs here called The Stand, which are the ones here are fucking fantastic, fantastic clubs as well. But the one in New York's same name, different owners, different logo. But it's a great club, and that comics table is great because it's not like a designated comics area. It's just this area that everyone, the comedians all just kind of end up gravitating towards and sitting down. And there it just becomes more, it feels way more like a natural fucking hang. And it's beautiful. And it's just like, bam. But then every now and again, you'll notice like, uh-oh. Everyone realizes all the comedians are here now, and there becomes this natural sort of disbursement. I swear to God, it's this weird thing where everyone's like, all right, five or six of us go step outside to have a cigarette. Some people go over here to order drinks, and now it's like, disperse. All right? Don't. Yeah. Okay? They're not paying attention anymore. Back. Because then it's just like, but then you go to like the Comedy Cellar, which is, you know, a great club as well. Obviously, it's Comedy Cellar. It's historic. That has like a designated comedians only.
Yeah,
no one else fucking even come near here if you're not a comedian table. And like I said, sometimes you go to that table and it's four or five other comedians that you fucking like and you're chatting. Sometimes you go and it's like, I can't even get near it because there's a ring of fucking sycophants just standing there at the table and waiting for their opportunity to be like, hey, You know, hey, Lisa Traeger, I love you. Or that, maybe not that sycophantic, but, you know, like, hey, Lisa, saw you on the show. You were great. And then, like, oh, hey, Michelle Wolf, awesome. Or, like, oh, hey, you know, Dave Chappelle, who's sometimes there. You know, oh, Mr. Chappelle. It's this. It's not the comedian's fault. It's that ring of fucking betas who just that ring of... I don't want to say betas. That's fucking mean. That sounds very...
It sounds a bit game.
It sounds a bit, yeah. That's not what I mean. But, you know, that ring of sycophants. This ring of, like, people who would rather go to a club and just hang out and hope to get noticed by someone more successful as just a person than go to a show and work on their craft.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a thing you see a lot of in New York, and it drives me insane, and I do not understand that mindset at all of... more important to hang out than to go work on your fucking joke. What? Are you dumb? What the fuck is wrong with you? What are you trying to become? Are you trying to just become someone's opener for life? Are you trying to just hang out in an entourage? Are you trying to actually be a fucking comedian? If you're good, they'll notice you. You know what I mean? Believe you me, any comedian will fucking tell you, they're going to notice you faster if they see you have an awesome set on stage because you've gotten good than they will if you just are always hanging out at the same bar and you're aware what everyone else is up to. In fact, most comedians hate that fucking person. Mm. Anyway.
Let's just talk about getting good then.
Okay, yeah.
Let's talk about the... We've got about 5 minutes. Let's talk about the decisions you made that creatively... that now you can look back and go, oh, that was one of the ways I got good.
Oh, I mean, I would say, and again, I just want to firmly put this stamp on this right here. Everything I'm saying is just what I think. Because I know, you know, I am also, if you look at my career trajectory, you know, where I am now, like, there are people way more successful, way more successful people than me in the States, and way more like in/hot/whatever, you know, comedians in the world that they're just going to be successful no matter what. I sort of exist on this outer trail that, you know, I do what I do though. But I do know that all that matters to me is being a good comedian. I pay no mind to all that bullshit.
Sure, understood.
All the lists.
Absolutely.
Right. So getting good for me just means creatively just... I don't like to rest on my laurels, right? The moment a joke gets to a point where it's a closer, I guess I get to work on the next one, you know? I write as much as possible. I do. I write as much as fucking possible. And sometimes that means sitting down in front of a notebook for half an hour and just getting too frustrated and then having to leave. Or sometimes sitting down for 4 hours and the day's gone, but you got some new bits, you know?
Do you have a particular strategy to get you out of those blank notebook times?
Push yourself through it. Just push yourself through it. Just understand that something you write might be fucking garbage, but you never know. Sometimes garbage can be recycled, huh? And you build a goddamn house out of it for people, for homeless people. There you go. How about that? Because believe you me, I do not kill my babies. That's a thing everyone likes to say. Do not, you know, you got to kill your babies sometimes. I don't believe in that. Just put them in a back shed, you know? Then come back. Like, sometimes a joke that may not work today, if I fucking believe in that premise enough, I will wait. Because I believe your sense of humor evolves as you do. So some of my best fucking bits that I have today are bits that 5 years ago I could not make work. And a year ago, I just was like, hey, what about that? And then just was able, because my sense of humor evolved, like, ha ha ha! And now it's ready. See what I'm saying?
What's the most satisfying part of your current show?
Most satisfying part?
Yeah, like technically to your comics brain, like you're like, yes, that. You know, like I nailed that idea, or that's the funniest.
Oh man, that's an interesting one, because you want to say the whole show, but I'll say, because you've seen it, and I won't be specific, but what I close on, because that is something I've for years have just thought was fucking funny based on what I've seen in the city, that most people are just like, what the fuck is this? But finding a place for it some where it actually fits.
Can you give us, I know what you're talking about. Can you give us a bit more? I know you don't want to spoil it for anyone that might see it.
It's this character I do at the end of the show who's a very crass individual. And says some very ridiculous, crass things that are just borderline absurdist. And it's based on a guy I used to see a lot in New Orleans. And I would just always kind of do this bit, and sometimes it would make people laugh, but most of the time, a lot of people were like, this kind of fucking seems like a crazy person. But finding a place for it at the end of this show where it kind of wraps up the whole theme was just like, oh, thank you, whatever comedy gods or cosmos there is out there, you know? Thank you, I've made my sacrifices. Or me, thank you, me, for fucking working hard and finding it. But either way, that's the most satisfying part, is just getting and having an idea that years ago you were like, I don't know if I'll ever find a place for this, but I fucking love it, and I'm just going to continue to do it. And now it's like, oh, the thing you end your Edinburgh show on, and it somehow gets everyone to laugh and then wraps it up perfectly. Ha! Ha ha! Told you don't kill that baby. I told you it'd be worth something one day.
So that was Sean. Thank you so much, Sean, for coming along and being on the show. I really enjoyed that conversation. So exciting to talk to someone so impassioned and with such a unique viewpoint on the whole art and craft of the whole thing. That's what we're all here for. So thank you very much to Sean. Thanks, of course, to The Place Hotel for allowing us a little bit of recording space. Do check it out if you're a baller and you've got some cash to flash and you're staying in Edinburgh. Do donate or buy a t-shirt. You've got 1 week left and then the t-shirt deal is over forever. And then we need to get someone else to design us an amazing t-shirt. Or we need Polly to do it again if she wants to. She's put such great work in. We'll need to... Well, she definitely gets first dibs. She's my official artist. But we'll do it again, but like not till next year or probably even 2 years. I don't want to be chucking a t-shirt at you a year. That seems excessive. But this is... That's your last chance. So a couple more days and then your only chance will be to grab one from my clammy paw. I nearly said sweaty. I nearly said suitcase. To grab one from me when I'm on tour, if you come along to some of the tour dates. So it's the tour dates /tour. It's the merch/merch. It's the donations /donate. And remember, if you can't do any of those things, if you choose not to, or if you're a million miles away, then I would be enormously grateful if you'd like to support the show in a different way, maybe by telling a friend or telling several friends or telling an entire class. Apparently, did I mention this? Apparently they're teaching this now. hello to you. If you are listening at any of the courses or casual comedy courses or indeed university type degrees in stand-up comedy who are or seem to be using this podcast as a textbook. Hello there. Thanks very much for listening. Wouldn't it be nice if you convinced your tutor to donate to the show in recognition of all of the lazy hours that they've managed not to teach you anything by simply setting listening to this as homework? I'm very glad to have you all on board. Do feel free though to support the show with a review on iTunes or on Castbox, Podcast Addict, Pod Addict, is it? Or wherever else you get your podcast. Stitcher, Spreaker, I believe that's a thing. Acast, is that right? So go along to all of those places, leave such reviews as are possible to leave, and generally spread the word and get more and more people involved. It's all good for Stew. That's all for now. Next week, we're still spoilt for choice. I've got so many good ones in the can. Will it be Sarah Kendall? Will it be Anne Edmonds? Oh, it was a corker. Will it be Julio Torres? Oh, my goodness. So many great ones still to come. Thank you for listening. If you'd care to stick around, I will chat to you some more in what, here at the Comedians Comedian Podcast, we call the post-amble. And if you are not interested in some other stuff going on in the world of my life, then feel free to sign out now, and I shall speak to you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye for now. Okay, so let's deal with a lovely email that I got regarding the Reginald D. Hunter episode. I think you might have over-explained in a ridiculously self-conscious way in the afterlog. The afterlog. Hey, that's not bad. That's the post-amble, the afterlog. Yeah, fine.
Oh, I'm sorry, I've clipped the wrong bit out of this email, and now I don't know where the original email is. Basically, someone is calling me a massive sexist, racist sex offender, but I think they're doing it in a fun way to gently mock me for what they saw as me being a little bit oversensitive in my discussions of the Me Too campaign and misogyny in general and men's responsibility to stand up and call it out and recognise it in themselves and recognise it in their friends, in other men, even if they are your friends. There's a lot to talk about there, and thank you for so many of you. A lot of you got in touch to tell me how much you enjoyed the Red Hunter episode. Some of you got in touch to rebuke me in a very gentle and polite way about the use of trigger warnings on the show. I don't know that I'm going to go into much more detail about that. I do accept that Reg used the F word, not the word fuck, the other F word, the horrible homophobic slur. He used that, and he used some other horrible words as well. Although I absolutely don't want to sanction what he said by not having picked him up on it, I'm sure you will understand that in what I'm doing here, I'm not just, it's not just banter with someone. What I'm trying to do in these interviews is try to get a sense of a person, try to get them to open up. I think that really worked with the Red Hunter episode, and I think it would really interrupt that process if every time my subject, if I can sound a bit psychiatric about it, if every time my interviewee said something or used a word or an expression I disagreed with, if I stopped them on it, if I interrupted them, then that would get in the way of the process, and I don't think I'm wrong to think that. Then they, with a conversation, moved on to whether therefore I should include trigger warnings for such slurs, and I don't. The answer is I don't know. I do accept that people are upset by hearing things like that, and I appreciate that people are upset by them, but I still think it's about incongruity. I think that a trigger warning is necessary if something is going to be incongruously offensive. And I think when dealing with adults doing stand-up comedy, it is not incongruous that some people have offensive views or opinions. It's congruous, I'm afraid. So I don't mean to be all, hey, life doesn't come with a trigger warning. I just think that it's a can of worms, isn't it? Because as soon as I start saying, there's a trigger warning now in this episode because this person says this, I mean, to be honest, there is a huge administrative cost to me, which will start to render the process much, much harder, and we'd have to probably do fewer episodes because of the time required to sift through the content. I don't want that to happen. And I also, there's lots of reasons. There's lots of reasons. So apologies. If you were triggered, then I'm sorry for that. Likewise, if you were offended by anything in that, which is the same thing, question mark, is it? Then I'm sorry for that. But some of the stuff is offensive, and perhaps I should have. Certainly, I don't want people to hear someone using homophobic slurs on this podcast and for you to think that that means I'm fine with it. At the same time, I don't think any of you think that. So that's where I am at the moment. I am happy to have a continuing conversation about that. I really am.
Hi, this is hashtag thanks Daryl, the person who edits ComComPod. First time I've had to do something like this. But basically, for some weird reason, the episode corrupted here. So you may be one of the people who pointed this out to us. Thank you very much. Very kind for spotting it. The original recording of what Stu says next is gone. So just for a little bit of context for what Stu next talks about is that he's talking about the fact that he's transitioning between the different phases of writing an Edinburgh show. He makes that quite clear. Next.
The phase of cracking open the new notebook and writing next year's Edinburgh show, which will become the following year's tour show. And I sort of took a picture of the first page of my notebook, which you can look at next to a quasi-ironic flat white. And I'm pleased to say that three writing days in, I've started to go, okay,
maybe I can do it. Maybe I can do it again. And the next phase is to assemble all of the stuff I've been thinking for the last few months and whazz it all on stage at Hell Week. The first one of those is on Monday the 27th of November, so a little way off yet. I've got plenty of time to think of funny things. I've got plenty of time. Monday the 27th of November, that will be at the Bill Murray in Angel, and the Tuesday the 28th and Wednesday the 29th of November at the Top Secret Comedy Club in Drury Lane in Covent Garden. So both of those, as you know, brilliant clubs, a very exciting attitude, both of those clubs, towards new forms of comedy clubs and new ways of making comedy work. And I'm really happy to be in both those places. I think they're all quite early shows. I think they're all 7 p.m. shows, but do double check on the show websites, or you can see the links on my Stuart Goldsmith Comedian Facebook page. Come along to one of those. The shape that took last year, the first time I tried it last year, it's basically I have a load of index cards with a load of really semi half to non-formed ideas, semi slash half formed. And I talk through them and try and make them funny. And it's, if you enjoyed Everyone's a Comedian, if you watched that on the Facebook Live stream, or if you were there in the room, it's a bit like that, except I'm using my own stuff. So the desperation to make it fly is even greater. And in all honesty, it's a lot less organised. So come along to those. Those will all be a lot of fun. They will be sometimes painful, always invigorating, and definitely a thing that you will have seen. So I hope you come along to one of those. That's it for now, I think. I think I've spruked at you all that I'm a spruke for now. I've been really enjoying... I really enjoyed... It's nice that the elements of the Reginald D. Hunter podcast... There's all sorts of elements to it, obviously. And certain of those elements meant that there's been a huge amount of correspondence, like a big bump in the correspondence. It's so great to hear from all of you. You can get in touch with me, info@comedianscomedian.com or @comcompod on Twitter, or join the Facebook group, as I've said. I've been really enjoying your correspondence, and I'm really feeling very satisfied at the moment and very nourished by the feeling that there is a wider community of people who enjoy the shit that we talk about on this show. Well, that'll do for now. Little sincere bit there at the end. Speak to you soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.